Welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 7.
There was stuff to do in there with the netstat commands. Then my questions were about 2 and 3, because it looks like 2 and 3 didn't actually have a lot that you're supposed to actually do. There was a lot of reading about Wireshark and stuff, but I wasn't sure what we actually needed to submit for those, or what you wanted us to do with that.
I remember looking at the labs and seeing that they were so based on what Wireshark was able to show you on screen that there was no feasible way of pulling the same information out with T-Shark in a reasonable time period. So it was more of a read and understand scenario so that you guys had some idea of what was going on. I hadn't found an appropriate way of modifying those to make them more useful, but it was always like, drill down to this, drill down to this, look at the stuff in this colour, look at the stuff in that colour. I'm just like, that's not going to be much fun with T-Shark.
Okay, so then do we just submit Lab 1 then? Like, just email you Lab 1?
Email Lab 1, unless I have a better idea as to what to do on the last two, and I need to look at them and see. Basically, the labs for this course are a pile, we're trying to make them not so much of a pile.
Understood.
Yeah, just with playing with Wireshark while you've been talking here, and I see one of the big problems is the whole window is treated as one big control, so there's no way to reclass it all as different options.
That's because the window probably is one big control as far as Windows is concerned.
Yeah, that's how it looks to me.
Interestingly enough, if you've ever played with Wireshark under Orca, it's actually more accessible. I wouldn't say accessible, but more accessible. Been meaning to try it on the Mac. I haven't done it yet, though.
Doesn't work at all.
Yeah, I tried that, and it was a very, very sad performance.
All right, then.
I think it was the voiceover tong, 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 tong noise, which, like, frustrates the Mac users incredibly, because there ain't nothing for voiceover to see. It's a bit like the sound your iPhone makes just before it dies horribly, and you can't swipe to anything or tap on anything.
Right.
Okay, this one's where you establish 4 Telnet connections to the bundle. This is 4.5.1 that I'm looking at here. So basically, you Telnet into the remote switch and the connections will sit around for 15 minutes. So what you do is just make one connection with TerraTerm, press Alt-N, make another one, press Alt-N, make another one, press Alt-N, make another one. So that's perfectly doable. I remember modifying that and going, yeah, they can do this bit.
Yeah, I've done that one. My question was more with the last one. The middle one, there might be things you could do in there, it's pretty hard because you gotta... I can see where they'd use Wireshark because it's asking you to identify, like, where the TCP, like, where it's acknowledged and where it's not. And, yeah, I guess you could do it with T-Shark, couldn't you? I've been trying to figure that out.
I had a go at that a while ago, and I think I managed to get some meaningful information out of it. I'll need Kerry to check to see if I'm not totally wrong, but it involved opening multiple command windows and starting multiple T-Shark sessions.
Yep, we'll have a look at that. You can see the sequence numbers, and you can see the ACKs, but unless you filter your T-Shark output down to exactly what your capturing, you're going to have a lot of log output, so you do have to be very selective with what you're capturing in the T-Sharks, otherwise you won't be able to see the forest for the trees.
Yeah, that was a problem.
Alright, I'll have a look at that, and I'll get back to you all on that, because it has been 6 months since I've looked at them, and I will take a look at those and see if we can make more modifications and make them more usable, and whether there is a feasible way of looking at the thing. Basically, what they're trying to show you is that each TCP connection is source IP, source socket, destination IP, destination socket. When you open a new TCP connection, the source IP stays the same, but the socket changes. The destination IP and destination port stay the same. So if you open a connection to a web server from 192.168.1.1, the first connection will come in on, say, port 1050 to web server :80. The next one will come in on 1051 to web server :80. The next one will come in on 1052 to web server :80. And that is how the computer differentiates between the connections. The source port source IP and destination port destination IP are what allows your network address translator to differentiate between connections. So when you go off to Facebook and then your significant other goes off to Facebook, the actual connections from the network address translator both come out from the same source IP, but on different source ports to Facebook. And then it is the table in the network address translator that allows it to send the necessary Facebook packets back to whoever's computer is currently on Facebook, if that makes any sense.
And those ports are just determined at random, right?
No, they're incremented. They are an incrementing counter. So you start at 1024 and work your way up. By the time Windows is booted, you're up to sort of 1030, 1040 from ports it's opened internally and stuff. And they just count up sequentially.
And then what happens if you, like, close your Facebook and stop using that one? Does it then just go back in as reusable?
No, what actually, well, okay, when the connection shuts down, so say you've got a port from 1050 to Facebook, when you close down, it keeps incrementing. So you don't reuse the lower number. You only reuse the lower number once you wrap at 65,535. Sorry, I think it wraps at 49,151, because look, there are certain rules as to where the ports wrap. I'm not exactly sure how the Windows stack does it. But then once you wrap, you can then start reusing the numbers that have been closed down.
Oh, okay, yeah, because I wondered about that, because even though it would probably take quite a while, eventually you would run out of ports, and then the whole thing would be totally screwed up, so I figured they must have some way around that.
I wanted to mention, too, that for anybody who is who listens to the Security Now podcast, Steve Gibson, they just did an episode, was it last week or week before, on TCP, and it's like it's how connections are made, and he covers it in extreme detail. So it's a neat one to listen to. I thought it was sort of relevant for what we're doing.
I'll have a listen to that one and see what it was like. One of the problems I had with Security Now was that Steve Gibson knew what he was talking about, and Leo didn't. So is this a good one for information content? Because a lot of the time it was like Leo being the average guy, and I found that sort of limited the directions in which they could go. I mean, I realise that's what most, you know, most of the planet wants, and I'm just being fussy. But I always found Leo was sort of very down to earth and didn't really know that much, and was sort of, you know, egging Steve on, so to speak.
I think that's what he does.
I'm not sure when you
podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know when you listen to it last, but it's pretty good. He usually gets in quite a bit of information, so I'd give it a try. See what you think.
I don't know how that Leo guy does it, because he does the Mac podcast and the Security Now one and the Windows one and the, I don't even know, there's some tech one he does. Like, I don't know how he participates in all those, being the down to earth guy, as Kerry put it, in all of them. Must be really.
Oh, he's got like 15 of them now.
To be honest, I didn't even know who he was, because unless you watch cable television over here, you've got no idea who he is. And I'm just like, who's this Leo guy? And then I basically watched a tech TV episode on SpinRite, and it's like, oh yeah, it fixes your hard drive, and it does this, and it does this, and it does this, and it does this, and here's our demo we're running here. And then I actually went and bought SpinRite and found out all the stuff that it didn't do and all of the smart things that it didn't handle and all the different things that didn't happen. And that's not Steve's fault. It's just what the program doesn't do. So that was interesting.
Do you know if you were able to get it to work accessibly
Okay, that's... I didn't get it to work accessibly, I got it to work usably. There is a difference. What you do to make SpinRite go... Okay, lesson one, it can't work on drives in USB enclosures, so don't bother. Lesson two, it doesn't work on external drives that are in little boxes that are all soldered up, so don't bother. Three, it only works on drives that are directly connected into your PC, and that are accessible from DOS, as far as I can tell. So, you know, the first two or three hard drives are fine, but once you get over that, you tend to have problems. The way to make SpinRite work is to make your own bootable disk. You can actually hack the FreeDOS one that it makes and modify the config sys, but it would be better to actually get the Windows system files. This is not quite relevant to today's lecture, but hey. The Windows system files, then put your own... take out the config sys that he's got in there, and then put the SpinRite executable on, and then make a batch file that does SpinRite space drive 0 space level 4 space auto space exit, and then you basically boot the disk, run the batch file, and read the log file when it's finished.
Oh, okay. Maybe I'll hit you up about that after.
My experience with SpinRite is that, yes, it can get some data back, but one of two things will happen. You will either get your data back, or the excess stress imposed on the hard disk via SpinRite will cause the drive to fail completely. And I've had that happen too. So, drive recoverers, beware.
Right, okay.
Alrighty. So we'll cover that. In fact, that might be a... that might be a topic for Thursday chat, Cavicast. I'm going to email Gibson Research and make sure that I am correct on some of my assumptions, and then we will do a podcast on data recovery, because it seems to be a hot topic, as lots of people seem to be knocking their external hard drives full of music off their desk, or similar.
Maybe I could try it again with the Weasel when you do or something, see if it even works.
Yeah, it'll work with the Weasel until it drops into the graph screen. The initial screens are text-based. And I did get it working with ASAP and hardware speech, but once the actual testing got started, you couldn't read the graphs and error counts and stuff.
Ah, okay.
Alrighty. Let's make a start on the material that we do need to cover in Module 5. And we will then see what time we've got left and what we want to do. Now, how's everybody feeling about the subnetting stuff? Does anyone feel more confident about the extra exercises for subnetting, or is there something I need to cover in those to get you guys familiar with the actual procedure of subnetting that's in there?
I just need to work through the examples a bit more and try to get my head around it. I don't know that there's anything more you need to cover. I just need to do more of it.
Yeah, I'll just have to just try it a bit more and then see where that goes.
Okay, because keep in mind, if you guys actually email me and set up a time, you guys can catch me on Skype if you guys have any questions. And I will warn you that all of my Skype recordings at home are recorded. So I usually delete the recordings, but I just have to tell you that they are generally recorded by default, which on the odd occasion that you wanted a copy of the call you just had with me is certainly possible. So just be aware of that. But other than that, I usually delete them a week after being recorded. How do I do that? MX Skype recorder. Great bit of kit. And some of you have me on... You have my home Skype. If you don't have me on your home Skype, either email, Twitter, or you can ask for a request to be added, and I'll stick you on the home one. So if you guys do have any questions, you can actually Skype me up and ask me.
Did you want me to backup record?
I've already started recording, so probably not now.
Okay.
That's why I made the point that SpinRite wasn't really relevant to this lecture, but there it was, so that's all good.
Okay.
Alrighty, I'll just put myself on AutoVox and we'll get started, or at least continue on, because I was talking about network address translation and stuff earlier. Does anybody have any questions about the previous content we've covered so far before I go on to stuff about the... I know Chris and John have emailed me about the TCP/IP book and have both got their copies. So anybody else who wants the TCP/IP book needs to email me and tell me that you're not going to distribute it and you will get a copy. It's not required for the course, but it has a lot of very good information on TCP/IP. Or you can go and buy it from the TCP/IP book website. But the author has let me give my students an older copy of the book at no charge. Oh, we're all sitting in the lobby. Should we all go down to lecture theatre?
Maybe.
Yeah, let's do that. There we are. Oops. I'll just give... Oh, there we go. You got it. All right. I was going to give you 20 seconds and then shift you down if I needed to. All right, let's cover the stuff we've got in this module. And nobody had any pending questions on the material covered so far? Is anybody coming out of these sessions with a better understanding of how all of that networky stuff works under the hood? Do you think you guys are beginning to understand the underlying procedures and stuff a little better?
I think so.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Alrighty, okay. Now, this is the network layer we're talking about. So, last week we talked about the transport layer, and the week before that we talked about the session layer, presentation layer, and applications layer. So, as you can tell, we are working our way down the OSI reference model from the top. And each module covers a different layer of the OSI reference layer, reference model even. Get it together in a minute here. And last week we talked about the transport layer. We talked about TCP. Anybody remind me what TCP is? Anybody remember from last week? If you weren't here last week, you're exempt from answering the question, of course.
Transmission Control Protocol?
Yep, there's acronym expansion for you. Anybody else tell me what it does? What's the characteristic of TCP that makes it useful to us from a data communications standpoint?
It does error correction and flow control.
Yeah. It... Ian. TCP, does it do error correction? I would have thought it more did error detection. TCP re-requests them.
Yeah, that's what I said. Oh, sorry.
Okay, I'm just clarifying something, guys. Hang on. Yeah.
If it is a segment that is corrupted and files a check...
Yep. Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. I was just... Yeah, so TCP... I don't like the term error correction, because error correction tends to infer that you're using, like, an error-correcting code or you're able to rebuild data. So the actual... I was just clarifying with Ian to make sure we both agreed on what it actually did. It actually does... detect errors if there's a bad checksum or whatever. If the headers are bad, then it's got to be done by the upper layer protocols. What TCP does is end-to-end reliable transfer of data. doesn't say anything about error detection or correction. So the understanding is that the actual data stream is reliable, but the way TCP does that is by packet retransmission rather than actual error correction. I don't know whether you guys are familiar with error correction as such. Error correction is the procedure where if you have one drive fail in a RAID 5 array, the error correction can rebuild the contents of the missing drive. Has anyone come across that?
I'm familiar with it. I don't know the mechanics of it, but I'm familiar with it.
Believe me, you probably don't want to know the mechanics of it. It's basically a matrix that you have to solve. And the Wikipedia article on Solomon error correction codes gave me a headache. But it basically looks at things, does a solve on a matrix, and can get back the missing portion of the data by using the redundant information that it put away to do that. Now, as far as Ethernet and general networking is concerned, they don't want to send more data than they need to over the wire because the carrying capacity of the wires is somewhat limited, or the communication channel is somewhat limited. So what we do in TCP, as we spoke about last week, end-to-end reliable, was that when a packet is sent, when the packet is acknowledged, it's considered to be received. You can have more than one... actually, I should be saying segment, sorry. You can have more than one segment in flight at once. That's what we call windowing. However, the receiver has to keep enough memory space free to hold the entire contents of the packet window. Because until you've got the missing packets, you don't hand the data up to the application. So if you receive packets 1, 2, 3, you can hand those up to the application. But if you then get packets 5, 6, 7, you have to wait for 4 and 5 to turn up. So what the application sees with TCP is a stream of data. So once the connection is open, it's a bit like a telephone call. You can have people talking to each other. You can have people playing music over the telephone. It doesn't really matter what's going over the communication channel, but the fact is that all that the application sees is a bidirectional stream of data in either direction. Yes, Corey.
Is this kind of then how denial of service works? They send you, say, they fudge the packets, so you have packet 3, and then they'll say, well, okay, now we'll give it packet 15 and make it wait, and then we'll give it packet 25 and stuff like that.
That doesn't work quite well because we expect packets to get lost on the link. The way a lot of the denial of service attacks work is, remember I spoke last week about the three-way handshake? The first thing that happens with a TCP connection is a SYN packet is sent, or a synchronization packet. The receiver then sends, and that puts the TCP connection in SYN sent state. And these connections come up in module 4. So SYN sent means the synchronization packet is has been sent. Then the receiver acknowledges the fact that the synchronization packet has been sent, and then it the initiator of the connection then sends another synchronization packet that actually contains data with payload. So when you are establishing a TCP connection, your first two packets don't have payload. payload, I think. I'll have to triple check that, but I'm pretty sure that's correct. So what they do with the denial of services is you SYN flood something. So you basically connect to a web server and open send several thousand different SYN packets, all originating from different ports, and then you sit around and wait. And basically the remote server is waiting, acknowledges the synchronization packets, and then gets stuck in that half-open state, waiting for the next packet to come out. And if you've got certain networking equipment, actually has a half-open timeout that says, if nothing happens on these half-open connections in a certain time period, don't bother. Just shut the connection down, because you're obviously not going to get anything. And that is one form of a denial of service attack, where you simply open thousands of connections to the web server, either from one machine or from a botnet of distributed machines, and you tie up all of its connection resources and leave the connections in half-open state.
So the defense against that is to essentially set up timeouts that are relatively small?
There's a couple of timeouts. There's a couple of defenses. One is setting up a short timeout, like a 5-second timeout on the connection. So if you don't see anything in 5 seconds of connection establishment, so you get SYN, ACK, and if you don't see something for 5 seconds or 10 seconds or whatever, shut it down. Depending on how slow your links are, you'll need to up that. So if you've got a satellite link with a long round-trip time, that won't be usable. But another thing is known as SYN cookies, and I don't know a lot about it, except that I believe it's deprecated. I would have to look it up and actually find out the mechanics of that, but there's some way of making sure those SYN packets are legitimate by putting something in them, and I'm not quite sure what that is, but that's another defense against it.
Okay.
You've got other attacks such as flood pinging, which is just where you send huge amounts of echo requests at something, and then if they reply, it ends up flooding their bandwidth in the other direction. And then the other sorts of things you've got there's some attacks like LAND-D and SMURF, which I'd have to look up, which rely on the ability to ping broadcasts and stuff. But you could have whole lectures on the sorts of denial of service attacks that still exist. The actual TCP/IP protocol suite is still vulnerable to denial of service. As some kids found out in 2008, they don't have a completely watertight solution to this problem at this time. One of the problems is, how do you differentiate between a denial of service attack and the fact that your site got slashdotted? For anybody who knows about slashdot, if your site is ever mentioned on slashdot, your web server is going to crash. It's almost a certainty. There is no web server that can stand up to the load of traffic that will hit your site once you are mentioned on slashdot, which is why the term to be slashdotted was coined.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's how that works. They've done various things to alleviate this problem now. For example, persistent HTTP connections. I don't know whether anybody knows, well, a few of you know how HTTP works, but basically you open an HTTP connection, you send a GET and a URL, and then you receive a web page. What used to happen was that you would send a GET request, you would get your data back with its headers and everything, and then you would shut down the connection. Well, what most modern browsers do now is they leave the socket open for 15 seconds or a minute or 2 minutes. I'm not sure what the timeouts in average browsers are. That's called persistent persistent HTTP. So what happens is you make a connection to facebook.com, you pull down the index.html, it then pulls down a whole lot of images and a whole lot of JavaScript and all sorts of things all on the same connection, and that allows you to use less connections, and it's quicker to use the connection that you already have open than it is to open new connections for every object you wish to retrieve off the website. Has anybody tried torrenting on an underpowered router and had the router fall over? Has anybody experienced that?
Yes. My first DDWRT box was a Linksys DDWRT version 8, which only had, I think, 8 megs of RAM. And so the maximum number of ports it could open was, I think, 1,024. And yeah, a torrent could kill that pretty nicely. So that's why I had to get a big...
Well, the other thing you could have done was actually limit the maximum number of connections in MuTorrent or whatever to 200, and your problem would have gone away. But, yeah, two ways of solving it. But, yeah, it's a very real problem, and you can actually run out of resources. And torrenting is a sometimes legitimate thing to be doing, especially if you're downloading Linux releases or whatever. And, obviously, it's... it can be like a denial of service attack, and some ISPs certainly feel that way about them. Okay, any other queries, questions before we move on? Alrighty. Okay, so the network layer is what we're talking about this week. Just to finish off what I was saying about error detection and correction. So basically what the application sees is a reliable stream of data. So you see whatever the application wants to send, and you see whatever the application wants to receive. Sometimes it goes fast, sometimes it goes slow, depending on the network conditions, but all the application sees is a stream of data. It's up to TCP to do the segmenting, the windowing, adjusting the window size, adjusting the timing. TCP also has a slow start, which is to say that it starts off slowly and picks up the speed of the connection once it knows what the capabilities of the peers are. Otherwise, you could unintentionally flood a network link that is incapable of taking that much data. So TCP basically has packets that are retransmitted if they're not acknowledged in a certain time frame. And those retransmits happen on an exponential back-off timer. So, you know, first it waits, you know, half a second, then 1 second, then 2 seconds, then 4 seconds, then 8 seconds, to try and stop retransmits from also clogging up the network. And I don't know whether you've noticed, but generally speaking, if you look at, like, good network conditions and bad network conditions, TCP usually works really, really well or really, really badly. So it just depends on what's happening. So that was to finish off the stuff on the end-to-end reliability and the error detection and correction and stuff. This is an interesting point, actually. A lot of people run traffic over SSH tunnels. So you SSH between a couple of machines, and then you do some port forwards to shovel stuff over an SSH connection to get it through a firewall or something else. There's a problem with this. If you have two layers of TCP, one on top of the other, if one of them clogs up, it can stall the other one and then cause packets to be extremely delayed and extremely laggy and very uncool, which is why Running a VPN over SSH isn't really a good idea, or running, say, OpenVPN over SSH, because TCP on TCP, as well as having a lot of overhead, is not an efficient way to shovel stuff around over the internet.
That's why Tor is so slow.
No, that's not why Tor is so slow. Tor is so slow because a lot of your relays are only giving you 20 kilobytes per second in both directions, and you're sharing those relays with everyone else. It's also a documented fact that more people need to be Tor relays, and most people can't be bothered figuring out how to set that up on their machine, which is why we don't have enough Tor relays. So, there you have it. Okie dokie. Now, the network layer encapsulates segments into packets for transmission over the network. So, at the network layer, we call them packets. At the transport layer, we call them segments. At the data link layer, we call them frames. And at the physical layer, we call them bits. And at the application level, we call them data. So, we have data, segments, packets, frames, bits. Data, segment, packets, frames, bits. There is a question on that in the exam somewhere. The network layer is responsible for addressing, encapsulation, routing, decapsulation, and that was lifted directly from the list of stuff that it does in the notes, because that's usually what I do. As we have already discussed, each device on an IP network gets an address, or each interface gets an address. Sometimes they get more than one address, but generally they get an address. And when a device gets address, it is known as a host. So basically addresses, network addresses and stuff are added at layer 3, and then they are sent down to the data link layer. And it's sent for transmission across the medium. So in your network stack, you've got your packets at layer 3 with your source IP addresses and your destination IP addresses, and they're put in there. And then the packets are handed down to the data link layer, where they actually travel across the Ethernet. And that's... it's actually the... it's actually the data link layer that's responsible for using the MAC addresses and stuff on Ethernet. John, yes.
So are there addresses at the... because doesn't TCP use addresses as well? You have the source and destination ports, or are there two addresses then at the IP and the TCP IP kind of layers?
At layer 3, you've got your IP addresses. Simplified, you've got your IP addresses, you've got your source IP and your destination IP, and at layer 4 you have port numbers which distinguish between the different conversations that are going on, so they could be considered as sort of addresses at the transport layer. You see, the problem here is that the TCP/IP layer does not directly map to the OSI reference model. So, to actually distinguish between a TCP, particular TCP connections, you need source IP, source port, destination IP, destination port, and that obviously pulls information from layers 3 and 4. Okay, TCP/IP is responsible for doing routing. As the packets you are communicating with may be on different networks. When it's on different networks, you need to get the packets from one network to another, and that is the job of the network layer. Each router that a packet passes through is called a hop. So if you picture a little kangaroo bouncing around the internet, every time the kangaroo touches down, that's a hop on a router. Or maybe it's a bunny rabbit. Maybe it's probably not a good idea to use kangaroos for you guys, because I don't think too many of you have seen a kangaroo. Grace saw some on Sunday. Okay, we've got some examples of network protocols. They include IPv4, IPv6, IPX-SPX. Nobody uses that too much anymore. And you've got AppleTalk and DECnet. There are two protocols that aren't used very much either. IPv4 is connectionless, media independent, and best effort. In other words, it'll try and get the packets through, but it makes no guarantee that the packets are actually going to get through. That is why you've got TCP. And it's up to the higher level protocols to handle the error detection, error correction, retransmission, windowing, scaling, all that sort of stuff. This reduces the overhead if you do this at the higher layers. IP itself doesn't have to worry about things. Network hosts are separated into groups to make things manageable. These are what we call subnets, and we've talked about subnetting a bit as we've gone through the course and worked some examples. And it says subgroups of hosts are called subnets, so luckily I agree with myself. You group things based on who owns them, location, and purpose. Now, does everybody understand that, or do I have to go into more detail? Because it makes perfect sense to me, but it may not make perfect sense to you guys. I have an example here that says, note that if you have, say, a group of graphic designers, they may have to have their own network because the amount of data they're throwing around is big, and you'd put them on their own subnet so that they can have their large print jobs and all those sorts of things.
That would tie into what you were saying before about like setting up a school subnet as well, right, to classify different things?
Yeah, exactly. Keep the traffic localized to the things that it's actually doing. Often administrative separations, say for example between your admin networks and stuff. Just give me a sec. Anne, did you want to tell Grace and see where she is, or...? Just Alan. Yep, okay. Yeah, if you give her a hotel, she'll get it and she'll be able to tell you where she is, because I have no idea where she is or where she's up to. Alright. So large numbers of hosts can impact performance, such as broadcast storm, which is where you have so many broadcasts on a network that it impacts performance. And that can happen if you have piles and piles of hosts and they're all doing ARP requests and they're all doing different things, and you find that the broadcast traffic is so high that you can't get anything else done. Has anybody... And I actually do this on my home network sometimes because I have no life. Has anybody ever tried doing a T-Shark with the filter set to ARP and actually watching which devices are doing ARP requests and then finding out that things are trying to talk to IP addresses that no longer exist on your network? I've actually found that if you actually do that and have a bit of a watch of what's requesting what for ARP, you can actually go around and reconfigure things to stop looking for devices that are no longer reachable on your network.
So, like, if you change the network share?
Sometimes if you change your network share, or you have a printer on a machine that no longer exists on the network, or something like that, or badly configured DNS servers, and that DNS server that you've got doesn't exist anymore, although most people don't have internal DNS servers like I do, that can certainly be a challenge. Now, broadcast domain is how far broadcasts travel. In other words, how you've sliced your subnet up will depend on how big the broadcast domain is. If you have a whole lot of machines connected together by hubs and switches, switches forward broadcasts. because a broadcast has to go out every port that the broadcast wasn't received on. So you actually create subnets to limit the size of your broadcast domain, because by default, routers don't forward broadcasts. Otherwise, they'd be called broadcasters. The actual machines split into multiple subnets means that when you do things like DHCP discovers and those sorts of things, that there are only a certain number of them and they're not going out to thousands and thousands and thousands of computers. Now, firewalls are a device that limits traffic flow on a network, and they aid security by doing so. They can stop some of the nasty stuff coming in from outside, and they can also stop some of the stuff that shouldn't be allowed out from going out. Is anybody, and this is becoming quite popular lately, is anybody on an ISP that disallows port 25 out of the network?
No, but with Comcast, I know they do. In certain cases, they can stop it, and then you have to reroute to another port. My ISP won't let me check mail off of, like, if I'm not on my cable provider, I can't use their email servers if I'm not on one of their IPs.
That's quite common. We used to do that with Lismore Internet. Can you authenticate to do it off-network, or do you have to use their webmail system?
You can receive through a different setup, but no, you can't even use their SMTP at all.
Yeah, and that's quite standard. The reason they don't do that is because if they did, yeah? Oh, okay. Cool. We just got the Haytel reply from Grace to find out where she was. The reality is that I've lost my train of thought, which is kind of ironic. If you have ISPs being able to accept email from anywhere without authentication and send it to anyone else, you have what's called an open relay, and the spammers love open relays. Ian loves spam, apparently. What, on sandwiches? Yeah, wasn't it you, Corey, that was telling the story about having the Windows mail server that wasn't locked down properly, or was that somebody else? I don't want to accuse the wrong person.
No, I take the blame as charged. That was me. My ISP was very, very, very angry.
Oh, if you think you had it bad, I did it on an ISP. We set up. I was actually around when spamming became big time. I mean, I remember when it first started, and the first one we got was, you know, Make Money Fast, which is where you send a dollar to, you know, the 10 people on this list, and they send a dollar to the 10 people on that list, and they send a dollar, and soon thousands of dollars will be pouring into your house. Apparently. However, the we had an ISP and we were running XSIM 1.92, so this was around about 1997. And we had open relays, and the spammers were shoveling stuff through our ISP like you wouldn't believe it. And we got blacklisted all over the place. And we all had to sit down and work out how to limit the who could connect and who was allowed to relay and who wasn't. So open relays are a problem. Anybody who is playing with mail servers, www.mxtoolbox.com. Very cool. Now, the other point that's covered here is dividing networks up allows the hosts not to need to know all addresses. So you don't have to know all of the MAC addresses for devices that are not on your local subnet. This keeps the size of ARP tables down. I've had all you guys run ARP from the command line before, haven't I? Everybody's run ARP-A from their command prompt?
No, I don't think so.
All right, everybody go and run ARP-A from their command prompt if they haven't done it already, and look at the things that turn up in your ARP cache. Your router will be one of them.
Is that because it has a DNS server running?
Has what got a DNS server running on it?
The router.
Which router? What? Why would DNS?
I just did it in. Oh, okay.
Okay, have a think. Why do you think the MAC address of your router would be in your ARP table? And anybody can answer this if they want to, but you get first shot at. Why do you think the MAC address of your router will be in your ARP table?
So it's the center of the network.
Not quite.
Is there a way to limit ARP?
Sorry?
Is there any way to limit ARP-A to a specific interface? Because I've got, like, virtual interfaces and stuff, and I'm getting all kinds of crap.
Let's have a look. ARP-?. You go ARP-N and the IP address of the interface. Let's see. Yeah, --N(IF_ADDR). So you can go ARP --N(the IP address of the interface you're interested in, and it will limit the ARP entries to that particular interface.
Thanks.
Okay, so we didn't quite get an answer to this. What does anybody else know? Why does anybody else know what the ARP table does? Have I covered what the ARP table does? I may not have covered much what the ARP table does. The ARP table is a table of hardware address to IP address mappings. So, hang on, IP address to hardware address mappings. I've got to get it around the right way. IP address to hardware address mappings. And that is used so that when you are talking to machines on your local network... Who's just turned up? Oh, how you doing? Suman's installed VMware on the second machine in, if you wanted that. I don't know where Ian's disappeared to. He'll be back soon. The ARP table has... is responsible for keeping a table of recently used IP addresses and the hardware addresses that they are associated with. So what you end up with is the ability to talk directly to a MAC address on the local Ethernet rather than having to mess around trying to talk to the IP address as such, because you need the MAC address to be able to talk to the other card. Given that information, can anybody tell me why is the entry for your router usually in your ARP table?
It's the first discovered device on the network?
No. Is anyone else awake? Apart from Corey?
I'm awake, but I don't know the answer, so I'm keeping quiet.
No, that's okay. It's okay if you don't know the answer. I'm just curious to know who else is awake. I'd sort of assume that nobody quite knows the answer I'm after, which is why I'm not getting the answer, but I just wanted to make everybody sure that everybody else was awake.
Yep, I'm awake. I'm just not totally sure of the answer. It's like Dave.
Okay, here's a thought, guys. Are you guys talking off your local network at the moment?
Yes.
So how are you going to talk to stuff off your local network? What are the packets going to go through?
Oh.
So because you're talking off network, all of your packets have to go through your default gateway, which is your router in most home setups. Therefore, your machine has to have the MAC address of your router in its ARP table so that it can talk to it. Everyone cool with that?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Now you've explained it, it does make sense.
Oh, that's okay. I don't expect everybody to be able to pick it up straight away, but it is sort of worth mentioning that if you need to talk to another device on an Ethernet, no, it's not. Oh, yeah, restart now. No, he needs to restart, or AVG is going to harass him. Actually, he's going to have to wait for me in, because I don't want him to pull 500 meg of VMware workstation down. We've already got it. No. Not yet. I'll be done in half an hour, but, yeah, it's not actually installed there yet, which is why I pointed him at the second machine in that already has VMware Player installed on it. Okay. Where was I up to? The gateway is the way off the current network. Hierarchical addressing uses the network portion to route stuff across network boundaries. So remember we talked about how the IP, the subnets were broken into, you had subnets and you had the network portion and you had the host portion. That hierarchical portion of addressing is how it's going to break that into different sections. Any questions so far? Okay, there are two types of routes. There are static routes, which are routes that your machine has put into its routing table and that are in there, either set by the administrator, or usually set by the administrator, or by the operating system if the routes are handed out via DHCP. And dynamic routes are ones that are learned by routing protocols. Have I had you all run route space print yet? I think I have, but does anybody want to run route space print at a command prompt? Or if you're on a Mac, you can crack a terminal and run route. I keep forgetting we've got people on Macs. The ARP command should also work on the Mac, I think, but it depends whether you were... You can try that later if you want. So if you run route from the command prompt, route print, or just route if you're under a Unix operating system, it will show you the contents of your routing table. Whilst you guys are doing that, just give me 5 seconds. VMware Player, if you log in on that machine with student password across. Okay, right. And in that routing table, has everybody seen their routing table? Has everybody run route print and got their routing table to show up? There's some odd entries in there.
Yeah, very odd. It's got a bunch of IPv6 stuff in there.
Oh, yeah, you haven't turned that off yet? Okay, my condolences. First thing I usually do on Windows 7 and VistaBox is to shut down the IPv6 stack, because unless you're running home group or your ISP uses IPv6, it's not very useful.
The persistent routes, is that when you set that up with the router? Or?
No. That's where you actually run the route command and actually tell it how to route to off-site networks, and you tell it that the route is persistent and Windows remembers those routes. So if you've got a network that you can get 192.168.20.0 that you can get through to by 192.168.1.8, you can put that in as a persistent route. So if you have more than one router on a subnet, it is perfectly permissible to be able to get to those other subnets by telling every workstation which other subnets exist via which routers. Now, most of you are lucky enough to only have one router on your network, and that way you can see what things what things you can reach. And here's an example of a table that is completely unblindly friendly and will make the average modern day blindy very upset, because no, you can't use Control, Alt and the arrow keys with your favourite screen reader. It's amazing the things we get used to. So you have to do it the old way of figuring out what all the columns are, and then count across the columns and do it that way. So you have network, destination, netmask, gateway, and interface, which is actually specified by an IP address just to confuse you, and the metric. Now, the metric is how much a route costs. The higher the metric, the more the route costs. So you might have two ways of getting to the internet. You might have three ways. You might have a cable connection, a DSL connection, and a mobile phone connection. And you might set the metric of the cable connection to 1, the metric of the DSL connection to 10, and the metric of the mobile phone to 20. And then you tell the router that all of those methods exist, and it can then utilize which ones it wants to based on what is available. Any questions on that?
Is the metric the higher the number, basically generally the slower the connection?
No, the higher the number, the more costly the path is considered. As in, how you define cost could be speed, could be expense, could be latency. It's up to you as the network administrator to decide what definition of cost you're working on with metrics.
Oh, okay, so just let you prioritize them. So the lower the number, the more preferred, if possible.
That's exactly right. Routers will take a route to a network with the lowest metric. So if you've got two routes to 192.168.28.0, one with a metric of 1 and one with a metric of 5, the router will use the one with the metric of 1 unless that fails, and when that fails, they will then fall back to the ones with a metric of 5. Hello. Alan, and that's it.
Okay.
You got my headphones? Yes. 0.0.0.0. Okay, so there is a special route which is known as the default route, and the default route is the route that packets take when they are going to any other device that you don't know how to get there. So, for example, the default route is always referred to by having a destination of 0.0.0.0. So, I'm looking at the entry.
Hi, how are you?
Now, so what we do...
Okay.
She actually walks better without the cane, but there you go. But he doesn't want that. He wants you to be as Reggie as possible. Now... so we have network, destination, netmask, gateway, metric. So I'm looking at mine. 0.0.0.0 is the destination. 0.0.0.0 is the network address, a network mask. So we have a network of 0.0.0.0 from the gateway to match everything. Hang on, let me check that. Yep. Now we have 192.168.100.11. That is the destination of the route. That is the destination of our router. Our router is .11, just to make some things unusual. We then have 192.168.100.132, which is the source address of my Ethernet card that is connected to that router. And then we have a metric of 10. Okay, so if we look at the actual route that points at the subnet, we have 192.168.100.0, because we've got a subnet of 192.168.100, 255.255.255.0, which is a class C, which you guys should all have seen before, 192.168.100.132, which is the source, which is the destination address of that route, 192.168.100.132, which is the source address of the Ethernet card in this machine, and a metric of 10. Does that make any sense to anyone?
I think so.
Okay, well, we'll let people think about that and see what they come up with. But that's basically the routing table in a nutshell. And my experience is that you will become much more familiar with how this is going. Now, keep in mind, just give me a sec.
Just be careful with the RAM allocation on your virtual machine.
Okay. As I said, the routes have a destination address, a next hop, which is the router that you're going to forward the packets through, and they're going to have a metric. And we've covered that fairly much. But what I would get you guys to do, where possible, is have a look at the contents of the routing table on your desktop, workstation, whatever. See if you can figure out what all of the IP addresses refer to. Have a look at the routing table on your router if you have the ability to log in and look at that. They've often got a thing that talks about the routing table. Remember that 0.0.0.0 is the default route and is what is handled, is how you can actually get packets off your network. Can you have more than one default route? You certainly can. Which one is it going to use? Depends on the metric. What if it's got the same metric on two default routes and they're both reachable? Well, it'll generally try to load balance between them, except keep in mind that it load balances based on packets, not connections. So you can't get two cable connections and hook them together and have stuff go really, 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 really fast without doing some gymnastics on the setup of things, because as well as getting packets out of your devices, you need a way for the packets to get back. And that can be somewhat challenging. Any questions? Yes.
I'm not sure if maybe this is coming up a bit later, but one of the things I was confused with the notes was it mentioned about if a router didn't know the full exactly where to route a packet, it would route it to a more general subnet or a more general network, and I was a bit confused exactly how that works.
So for example, you're actually looking at, two routes in your router. What they're trying to tell you is, say for example, if you've got a route to 172.16.28.0, a Class C route, and then you've got, oh, that's probably not a good example. Say for example, you've got a route to 172.16.28.0, but in your router you've only got a route for the 172.16 network, then the router will forward the packets to the 172.16 network because it's a bigger route prefix and it doesn't have a specific route for the 172.16.28 network. So the assumption is that the 172.16.28 network is reachable by the 172.16 network.
Okay, that helps.
So, if you think about Alice and Bob, then what you're looking at is, if you've got Alice, Bob, Charlie, and Daryl, then assumedly the outside routers know about the 192.168.1 network, but they don't know about how to reach the different subnets for Alice, Charlie, Bob, and Daryl, and it's not up to them to know. So all they do is hand it to the router on 192.168.1.0, and then it's up to the router for those four people to do that. So the router on Alice, Bob, Charlie's, and Daryl's network is responsible for sorting out to which sub-subnet it needs to go. So all you do is put the destination IP in a packet, and it's up to the routers to figure out where that packet goes. You don't have to locally hold routing rules for every subnet on the internet. Ian's walked out, hasn't he? Oh. No, it won't, because he's useless at the command line. Me. Maybe working with him, but, like, trying to tell people what to type is an exercise in frustration. Any other questions? Alright, well, if anybody doesn't have any questions, I will stop recording for this at this point in time and try and get some extra stuff up. I will relook over those labs and clarify what needs to be done. I will probably bite the bullet and install the beta and have a play with Wireshark and see if I can get any more sensible information out of it. Yeah, we'll see how we go.
I did have a quick question, actually, and it might not be relevant for this, but I've heard of Layer 3 switching. What's the difference between Layer 3 switching and routing?
The difference between Layer 3 switching and routing is that the switch makes decisions as to which port stuff is going to based on the IP address of the packet rather than the MAC address. And you can use that to do things like virtual local area networks, which means more than one network on a cable. And that way you can switch things very quickly with a switch, but it actually opens up the packets and looks at the IP address rather than just the MAC addresses.
Oh, okay.
That'll be exploration 4 when we get to that.